Thank you, Charlotte, and thank you, Sebastian, and thank you all for being here. All the talks so far have given me a great deal of food for thought in my own work, so thanks to everyone who's presented for giving me such stimulating precursors for what I'm about to say. We've seen throughout this talk, or throughout this thing, day, a number of striking and well-known iconic images of the earth, of the environment, and looked at the way in which these are used, interpreted, put together, really looked at their histories, the multiple layers of information of actors involved in constructing them, some of the political consequences of them as well, and the very fine grain analyses of the construction of these images and their uses that we've heard for the last 2 days has been really inspiring to me. Really tracking them in terms of how they connect to their objects, but also how they connect to the worlds that they then circulate in. So again, that's been quite inspiring. Speaking as a historian of science, but one with a background in anthropology, I want to suggest that images like these iconic images of the environment, not be seen just as pictures of the earth, but as pictures of the world, and then that we expand what we mean by world and acknowledge that these are also images of the cosmos. These represent a view into what our cosmology is, what it's becoming as well. And that what I mean by that is that they inscribe a certain relationship or multiple relationships between humans and the natural world, assumptions about that relationship, as well as in various ways, point to the ways in which they're formed, the ways in which people interact with the world and with each other to realize images like that. So there's a lot going on in these images, and they're not just talking about the earth, they're talking about really where we stand in relationship to nature and really where we are in the history of nature, the history of this very complicated concept that is so definitive for Western society and for the world. And so the term of cosmogram is meant to replace and expand the notion, obviously, of diagram. These are images that aim to present the universe as a whole. It's a big picture, comparative notion, and is meant to invite thinking more broadly and comparatively about images like the ones we've been talking about. Usually when we talk about cosmograms, the term itself comes from, not that we usually talk about this word, but the term itself comes from religious studies. First of all, I'm going to have to learn the directions on this. Examples have been given in religious literature of the Ark of the Covenant, which divides up the tables of the law and divides clean and unclean and contains the census. Cathedrals, as inscriptions of the medieval Catholic world order. Panofsky's analysis of the cathedral is exemplary here. Buddhist mandalas as well, as depictions of the spiritual and natural realms and their interactions. But of course, science also draws cosmograms, as in Bacon's plan for the great instauration, Darwin's tree of descent, and Haeckel's as well. Cosmological epics, like the popular US series Cosmos, directed by Carl Sagan and now recently updated with Neil deGrasse Tyson. All of these underline the fact that Western science, like religion, is very much involved in not simply facts, but narratives, in telling histories of the world and placing us within a wider frame of meaning, structures for the life world we inhabit, both implicitly and explicitly. Now, I know that the term cosmogram is quite vast, like the word cosmos itself, and it's quite unruly. How do we limit its application? Because like cosmos, it tends to bring in everything. And I'm not particularly worried about that. I'm inviting people to think about more broadly how the kinds of images that you see in environmental sciences are part of a wider conversation that humanity has been having about itself. In a very important sense, however, the term is more restricted than something like cosmology or worldview, because these are terms that speak of a general set of images or ideas or concepts, symbolic frames, which are impossible to pin down, right? Which float in the air and transmit themselves vaguely through influence. In the case of a cosmogram, it is actually something concrete that someone drew or wrote down at some point. You can point to it. You can ask questions about who made it and how it was made and what use people put to it. So it takes this big question of the human sciences, of the cultural sciences, of what are people's worldviews, what are their symbolic forms, and gives you an object to pin it down to. Of course, it doesn't mean that that everyone who is in the range of a cosmogram necessarily adheres to it completely, nor that it's complete or absolutely coherent. But it does mean that here is a point at which people strove to contain as much of their world as they could. And therefore, it's open to some kind of empirical analysis. There's a great new book by the photographer Michael Benson called Cosmographics. Oh, sorry. I mentioned those images, but I didn't show them. Cathedrals and good old Carl Sagan. Does Carl Sagan exist in France? No, okay. Because he made this film or this ongoing series, Cosmos, which he is the presenter of science from the 1970s to the 80s, the face of reasonable cosmology in the US. So in this book by Michael Benson, it's called Cosmographics. It's a kind of art book, but also a science book, which contains a number of images in the Western tradition of the cosmos, including this one by Hildegard von Bingen from the 12th century. One of the things that's interesting in her representation is that the text that goes along with it points out not just what it's showing, but also limits of what it shows. The omnipotent God, incomprehensible in his majesty and inestimable in his mysteries and the hope of all the faithful. So that images of the cosmos both present something explicitly and frequently point out what they don't show. And this is true of Hildegard von Bingen. And again, another Hildegard image where you've got the cycle of the seasons imposed on the earth in this geocentric image. The conception of time as cyclical, as well as the different elements of the Aristotelian system, all embedded in this image. But what I like particularly is this little inscription here. It's sort of like the methods section in a scientific paper. There she is depicting herself, recording the mystic vision. So there's a scene in which the image shows you how it was made and gives you a kind of a sense of how reliable it is, where it came from, and who the author of it is. So it's, in a sense, meant to be traceable, even as it depicts all that is beyond human immediate comprehension. So there's a kind of reflexive interest in metadata that Hildegard is putting forward here. Or from the 16th century, the Neoplatonist Francisco Holanda of Portugal has this magnificent series of Neoplatonic visions of Genesis, how the earth was placed in the center of that geocentric image through the fiat lux, the divine statement of let there be light. And some of these really look like early 20th century suprematist paintings. They seem to anticipate a lot of the figures of modern art too. Now, in the canonical story of modern science, in the 17th century, there was another fiat lux, another let there be light, with the rise of the mechanical philosophy and Newton. Aspects of this shift in cosmology are summarized by historians of science, as suddenly the universe has lost its bounds. We're in an infinite universe. Efficient causality is the dominant mode of explanation. There's a mode of observation and representation that emphasizes a split between subjects and objects, and the mechanical world picture captures all of these elements. Also the idea that there's a single scientific method tying it all together. Of course, as people who do the history of science, you know that this is a great simplification of what was happening in the 17th century, but it's a powerful narrative for what modernity was about, this new cosmology. And Coiré, in honor of whom the center was named, summed this up with his title very eloquently, From the Closed World to the Infinite Universe. Aspects of this new cosmic order are summarizable here, that it's mechanical, materialistic, and objective. And I like this new phrase of MIMO to summarize these. I like this term because it's got a few different resonances. One, a memo is a tool of bureaucratic administration. It's a message that's sent out as if from nowhere that everyone has to automatically obey, usually from the director or the management of a corporation. It is like a meme, like Dawkins' notion of something which is a unit of meaning which is instantly virally spread everywhere. But it also sounds like Le Capitaine Nemo from Jules Verne, which the root of that term is no one. right? No one's responsible for the statement of the world in terms of mechanism, materialism, and objectivism. It's just there and suddenly everywhere. So this authoritative and ubiquitous, as well as unattributed aspect of knowledge in MIMO is what I want to suggest with this term. Now, those who have been theorizing the current cosmological disposition that we're in, thinking about the Anthropocene, this term which has been launched as a possible new geological marker for the age we're in, have in many times suggested that the world detailed by Coiré and the cosmology detailed there, which I've summarized as MIMO, may need some adjustments, may be undergoing some kinds of transformations. With the geological confirmation of the effect of human activity on the planet, our understandings of both the human sciences and the natural sciences might have to change. The infinite gaze of MIMO is now directed inward towards the Earth and towards the arrangements of knowledge, the intentions, the political histories, the cultural meanings, as well as the industry that have shaped and are continuing to shape this fragile planet. So moving from the closed world to the infinite universe, from the universe closed to the infinite world, a collection of writings on the Anthropocene, shifting Coiré's terminology and his understanding. Some suggest that this implies a new cosmological orientation. And if that's the case, it's worth thinking about what kinds of objects might embody or frame this new cosmological orientation. What would be the cosmograms appropriate to this new uncertain state? This may mean, if not an end to MIMO, a circumscription of it. New ways encountering the world that don't make representation, quantification, and discursive argument, or necessarily efficient causality, their primary modes, moving beyond proofs, graphs, numbers, or somehow adding to them in the range of means of representing this new uncertain state. So that's why I think the term cosmograms is particularly useful for this moment and thinking about representing the environment now. But backing it up, it's a tool for comparing this moment with different natures, different cosmological orders, and the different kinds of arguments that they have made. And it allows us to do this, make these comparisons at three levels. One is, I'm calling the ostensive level, just pointing to things, what it shows. What things are there in the universe? What entities are classified? What are those classifications? What are the principles of order? What are the different domains that the world is classified into? Natural, supernatural, human, non-human, living, animate, inanimate, different kinds of causality. How are those represented in these images of the whole? So that's one level at which we can look at cosmograms. Another is in terms of what it does. How the performative aspects, what kinds of social effects does it produce? What kinds of new entities come into existence or are enshrined or organized or validated by these representations? And the subtitle of my talk, How to Do Things with Worlds, is referring to J.L. Austin, the philosopher, How to Do Things with Words, which analyzes the performative impact of certain statements, certain words which don't just describe the world, but actually produce the world. And in what ways do cosmograms likewise produce new kinds of realities, produce new kinds of visibilities, new points of anchorage for activity in different ways. So the performative aspects is another domain. And finally, reflexive aspects. And Birgit asked me a question about cosmograms at one point that's prompted me to add this extra level, which I think is extremely important. Like the image of Hildegard von Bingen in the corner, showing how her image was made, it's important to ask, how do these images represent their own history? How do they represent their own mode of existence? What kind of communication are they? Are they claiming to be direct reference? Are they claiming to be propositions or conditionals? Are they statements in a framework of hope? Are they statements in a framework of realism? What mode of representation are they using? What kind of a thing is a cosmogram? And there are different possibilities for that. So the aim is a comparative perspective on forms of order, on systems of meaning, and the active composition of the cosmos. And it's one that doesn't take for granted, as necessarily given outright, the modern demarcation between science and non-science, between science and religion, between cosmology as a subfield of physics, and cosmology as what anthropologists and religious scholars study as the whole system of meanings that people use to interpret the world. And this, of course, relies on the idea that there is not just one nature, not just one cosmos, that human action shapes many different sorts of cosmological arrangements. Now, the anthropologist Eduardo Viveros de Castro and his notion of multinaturalism suggests this, but we also get help from Philippe d'Escola, the anthropologist, with his book, Beyond Nature and Culture, which has helped to spur an ontological turn in anthropology and in science studies. His argument is that among all the different ontological possibilities, the different kinds of cultures and understandings of what being is in the world, there are basically just four roots. Among all the diversity, and people have criticized this for being incredibly reductive, but I think it's useful to say there are more than one possibilities. There is more than one possibility for what the cosmos might be, but not necessarily an infinite number. There are certain regularities that appear and have appeared in human history. So the one that's most familiar to us, he calls naturalism or mimo. It's the dividing of the world between subjects and objects. A nature which is externally the same as humans, but where there's an internal dimension of meaning and intention, which makes us different from other non-human things. And he refers to Descartes as the model of this, and Descartes' skull sums this up, the strange difference between thinking substance for Descartes and extended substance, and the human as this unique merging of these two kinds of being. But this, again, is not the only way of organizing the cosmos. He talks also about totemism associated with Australia and parts of North America. And in totemism, there is an essential identity recognized between certain parts of nature and of humans, both inside and outside, so that the totemic animal is seen as being the same kind of being as members of that totemic tribe or clan. As far as the mode of representation of totemism, the totemic animals are seen as sacred, and any inscription of the animal, whether in a tattoo or in a work of art, has a kind of sacred power to it, has a force to it, which Durkheim analyzed in The Elementary Forms. It's not just a sign. It doesn't function and represent in the way that the signs, numbers, and graphs of the Newtonian model or of naturalism represent. A third possibility that d'Escola sketches is animism, visible among many Native American peoples, in which non-humans are taken to have different kinds of bodies than animals, and yet they have the same kind of internal characteristics. So that for parrots and jaguars, they see each other as different kinds of animals, but parrots see each other as humans. And so that, and jaguars understand themselves as humans and see humans as different kinds of animals in their cosmology. So in animism, basically some things have a soul, like humans, but we appear different to each other because we have different physical bodies. In this framework, representation is often in the mode of incantation when the cosmos is represented, in terms of modes of address to animals with whom one has a kinship, where magical words have to be said in order to apologize to animals which one is going to kill for subsistence, for example. The formalities for moving between these domains are usually in the hands of shamans who understand the ways in which you move between the different ontological domains of the world. And finally, analogism, that is a system of the world organized according to correspondences and analogies. According to d'Escola, the idea is that in this view, the world has infinite differences within it, multiple ranges of things that can be broken up into many different distinctions. So it's a world of constant Heraclitean flux, right? Everything is in change. In order to organize that instability, the concepts of microcosm and macrocosm come into play. And so structures that map those two together between body, state, and cosmos are crucial and are ritually instituted. In ancient Chinese philosophy and science relies upon two notions. On the one hand, the idea that everything is constantly changing, that there are infinite differences in the world, and on the other, this imposition through ritual of great parallels between microcosmic and macrocosmic phenomena. So these are four different ways of carving up nature, of understanding nature, which presuppose different relations between humans and non-humans. And as I've tried to suggest, they also bring with them different ways of representing, different ways of understanding how signs work, how symbols work, different regimes of signs. So in my next sections, it's worth recalling that analogism, this merging of microcosm and macrocosm, also exists in Western science, particularly in the early modern period, as in this, the work of Robert Flood, which was all about finding the correlations between the very large and the very small. Although these are distinct cosmological orders usually associated with different cultures and regions, they may exist in parallel within a single society. So I want to offer a few examples of cosmograms in action, or cosmopragmatics, to make sense, to help you, you know, flesh out this term a little bit, with three examples taken somewhat randomly, let's say, by chance, from different moments in time. So one, to go from medieval India. This is an example from the 8th century. There was a king, Lalitaditya, who defeated a rival. And one of the roles of a vanquishing king is to establish a new temple, which sets up a new cosmic order. And as King of Kings, he decided to do so, but moved the capital city from where it was near Nepal much further north, and which was his home base. In doing so, he stretched the map of Indian cosmology, and literally within his view, and within the view he was able to impose, redefined geography, redefined the center of the universe around the temple which he built. So it's a great chain of being where the proximity to the temple that has been built is a marker, is in parallel to proximity to divine perfection. And it literally redraws a map, literally redraws the surface of the earth. And the temple itself also contains a chain of being. At its center is a statue of Vishnu, which the king and servants of the god have access to, but in declining orders of rank, you have access to that center. So there's also a social hierarchy built into the physical hierarchy of the building, which is also a redrawing of the cosmic hierarchy. This is all realized and enacted through the making of this cosmogram, of this new temple. Another example taken from Islam, and just to remind you that maps of the earth come from somewhere, and what you put at the center and what you value is most important has a lot to do with what group you're in and what your cosmology is. Here we've got a medieval map of the earth with Mecca and Medina at the center, not Jerusalem, right, and not any claim to be a physical, neutral, realistic depiction of the earth. Rather, the places of the most spiritual value are the ones that are placed in the physical center of the map. And I think it's worth thinking about the Hajj, or the pilgrimage to Mecca, that people take traditionally following this tool which you find in all history of science museums, Islamic astrolabes, this kind of portable GIS instrument that allowed people to know what time the sun was rising, what time the prayers would be, and where Mecca was in relation to where they were. This was a big part of orienting everyday life to this single cosmic point, which was Mecca. And in people's individual biographies, they enacted this cosmogram by taking the pilgrimage to Mecca, and that's still done today, and is part of a gigantic tourist industry to charter groups from various countries to go to Mecca regularly. Obviously, there are massive urbanistic questions about how to organize these millions of people who visit this single site, huge environmental consequences and burdens placed on this region, but also interesting interplay between unity and diversity, where on the one hand, Mecca, as under the control of the Saudi royal family, is a site for massive promotion of their interpretation of Islam, right, of a Wahhabist fundamentalist view of Islam, whereas the people who actually participate in the Hajj can have many different interpretations of the individual meaning of this collective experience. So, like with the case of India, it's something performative. This world order is established by people enacting it, by it having been built up and changing over time, the form of this ritual. And the ritual itself exists in time as a process. But also, it involves serious questions of administering large numbers of people across vast distances, and likewise allows both for a certain role of authoritative statement, like this is something that everyone has to participate in, but also room for individual interpretation and experience of it. So both unity and multiplicity. Now, a last case coming from the Western tradition, back to Seville in the 16th century, thinking about the Casa de la Contratación, which was the center of Iberian trade. It was under the power of Queen Elizabeth, and it was a place where taxes and duties were collected. All voyages that went out to the New World had to be approved there and had to bring their findings back. Voyagers had to take an oath that whatever new they discovered would be reported in this place, in this house, and also would be mapped on the Padrón Real, which is the secret map of New Spain, which marks all the landmarks. And there's a really interesting controversy that shows up in the 16th century in the Casa between cosmographers who are working for the king and queen who are using astronomical reckoning to identify maps versus the pilots who are using dead reckoning to mark where they're how they get from one place to another. A huge controversy about then how you make the map. Like, what are the principles you use? Is it being there and seeing, getting from place to place? Or is it the sort of God's eye view, the Apollonian view, based on astronomical reckoning? And that's, of course, a political struggle between different experts, different kinds of expertise, which is all administered within this legal framework of the crown, with, of course, the oath that's taken with God, right, the oath taken to God, built into the system too. So all these actors are here, and it becomes a site not of agreement, but of real conflict, of struggle between different kinds of interpretations of the cosmos. 5 minutes. Okay, so I'm going to fast forward through some slides. One thing I want to say is that these are interesting examples, I found them interesting, and I'm trying to say that they allow us to think more broadly about what goes into modern environmental representations. The performative aspects, the idea of bringing lots of different people in, the interplay between authoritative and multiple interpretations that can happen, as well as the performative, the way in which a new kind of reality is produced. I've said that in the Newtonian view, in the view of Mimo, this is a mononatural view. There's only one nature, there's only one mode of seeing things. But in fact, if you look at the history of science, people have recognized that there are many, many more visions of what nature can be and has been. And that's an important thing that the history of science can contribute to conversations like this one, pointing out that there are many different methods and styles of knowing. To quote Ian Hacking, thinking about the different eras of objectivity, thinking about different civic epistemologies, as Jasanoff calls them, different moments in which aspects of these other cosmologies that Descola talks about come into play within Western science, animism or analogism, for instance. Going back to Flood, this is not just a speculative reckoning, it's also incredibly precise and, well, not incredibly precise, there is a domain of precision and technique and realism built in, along with images of the structure of the cosmos, just representations like this. Flood was designing some of the first thermometers to measure heat, some of the first thermoscopes with a standard gradient of heat. So these kinds of speculations in the history of science, often dismissed as just natural magic or kind of astrology or Rosicrucianism, are actually laying the foundations for another mode of representing and another mode of registering the world, which will then manifest as Newtonianism. But there are also, in the 19th century, so often seen as the age of Laplace, the age of triumphant mechanism, other visions which are coming into Western science, informed by Romanticism, for instance, the idea that aesthetics or subjectivity or personal experience or poetics are crucial for creating an understanding of the world. Romanticism and early industrialization actually went together very strongly. This is the book I wrote about it, the Romantic Machine, about how in Paris, a number of people deeply involved in engineering were also informed by this alternate view of nature and how we know it that's coming from Romanticism. among the people who are caught up in this merging of the technical, the machinic, and the subjective and aesthetic and utopian are the Sansimonian engineers who designed this amazing temple that would summarize the whole world in a new world religion. They're also designing the first, perfecting some of the first steam engines and building the rail system in France. These two things go together. Alexander von Humboldt, very much a proponent of romantic poetics and philosophy and naturphilosophy, also lays the groundwork for precision science and environmental science as we know it today, doing both of these together at the same time. Auguste Comte, the founder of positivism, didn't just define the different distinctions between the sciences and the epistemic thresholds of the sciences, but realized a religion of humanity where these all had to be tied together as a new kind of collective practice, along with new gods, a new fetishism. He used the term fetishism, a return to what he saw as a primitive animism and an effective emotional relation to the earth, according to Comte, is what would tie together all the fragmentation and specialization visible in the sciences. That's the part of Comte that you don't hear about from Bachelard or from courses of epistemology, but for Comte, that was the final realization of positivism, merging all of the different sciences and techniques together in a harmonious, effective, emotional whole. So these all exist in the history of science, and we can try to retrieve some of them to think about the kinds of images we might want to make now that have not merely a rational force, but also an emotional force, a cosmological representation that actually captures more of the vast and complex reality that we inhabit. 2 minutes. So I think what I wanted to do is just suggest three examples of attempts not from the 19th century or the 16th century to represent the cosmos, not merely in the representational or MIMO or Newtonian modes that I mentioned, but attempts frequently done by artists and also in political settings. To represent perhaps some of the uncertainties at the same time as the scientific facts, as much as they're in debate, of the Anthropocene. So, thinking about cosmograms of the Anthropocene. So I'm gonna go very quickly. You've seen a lot of these images, the Earth from above. Pardon? I think it's worth thinking about political manifestations as also cosmograms. What kind of world is being represented here? How is it enacted? Interesting that in the climate march, a lot of arguments that are constructive or scientific were put forward, and just the fact of numbers, right? That these are all, we can count them and therefore it's real, right? It's all organized around the 350 degree org goal. There is a question which has been raised many times in discussions, whether arguing in terms of numbers is sufficient and whether it actually succeeds in getting us out of the kind of thinking that led to the rapid industrialization and the anthropogenic climate effects that we are so concerned about. So I want to think about just briefly some non-MIMO cosmograms, right? Non-Newtonian cosmograms. Some of this is coming from indigenous movements which claim the Earth as a living thing and incorporate it into their political projects, like the Idle No More project in Northwest America and Canada, and Ecuadorian constitution for the rights of nature. Nature is presented as an actor which is capable of political protections and rights. And it's interesting to see how this rhetoric has fed into the climate march as well. The indigenous peoples are said to be on the front line. So different peoples and their different nature are brought into these new political representations. I have a lot of other images, but I would be happy to show them to you at some point. And I think I'm just gonna stop here with this point, thinking about not just paintings, pictures, graphs, and arguments as representations of the cosmos, but thinking about the performance of these cosmic realities, thinking about how they happen in time, how they mobilize many people, but in specific sites. Thinking whether those are temples, cathedrals, whether they are in scientific lecture halls, or in the streets. What kinds of ways are people manifesting themselves, their differences, but also their shared values? How do these represent the cosmos? And we should think about how the images that we produce and critique feed into and support those kinds of representations too. So thanks a lot.